when George Washington was inaugurated the first time, becoming our first president under the U.S. Constitution, on April 30, 1789, he made some remarkable statements about God and America. We're going to talk about that right now with Dr. Peter Lilback on this portion of Vocal Point. I'm Jerry Newcomb, and Dr. Lilback and I wrote a book together many years ago called George Washington's Sacred Fire. Dr. Lilback, it's so great to have you back on the program.
Jerry, I always love this conversation. It's one of our favorite topics.
I do too. I enjoy it a lot. Okay, let's talk about when Washington was inaugurated, and you can go ahead and just say a few of the details, and then we'll get into his inaugural address, because that is loaded with Christian imagery as well.
Yep. So as we think about the inaugural address, one of the amazing things about it is that it is overflowing with his sense of divine providence, his favorite theological doctrine.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting to me, having studied Washington's life, is that there's one particular point where he's writing to one of his officers named Thomas Nelson, and he says, that man is wicked indeed. He's worse than an infidel that cannot see God's providence in how God had bottled up the enemy into New York and had preserved the American cause, and that the British army had been humbled down to pickaxe and shovel, where once they were filled with so much power and might. And he says, but I'll add no more on the doctrine of providence and turn preacher later. So it's kind of a way of saying, you have to believe that God has been blessing our effort, because there's no reason we should be in such a place of progress against such an extraordinary, powerful enemy, and that we are able to see how we are advancing toward our goals. This is God's work. But this providence is something I'm going to talk about later. Well, I would suggest his promise in that letter that I will turn preacher providence later occurs when he's now elected as the first president of the United States under the Constitution. So the inaugural address is really his occasion for the very first time to speak as the president of the United States with a Constitution that's intact. Remember, before this, there were presidents, but they had been under the Articles of Confederation or had been under the Continental Congress's progress of trying to build a new government. But this was now the first time of this new beginning of a system of government that has held to this very day. Has been amended, of course, through the years,
mm-hmm.
and that was by its very design. They realized it could not be perfect. But for Washington, he realized that everything he would do as the first president was going to set a precedent for all who followed him.
Mm-hmm.
And in that unique role of speaking for the first time, his inaugural address was given. And one observer made a very fascinating comment. He said, as Washington gave his inaugural address, his voice was quivering while the papers were shaking in his hand as he was reading them. He said, this is a man who never trembled before an enemy's bullet, but it was overwhelmed with emotion as he was sharing his first inaugural address. So this was a deeply passionate moment for Washington. He didn't see himself as a great public orator. He saw himself as a leader, a man of principle, but now he was thrust into the highest place of government. And even as he felt he was inadequate to be the general of the troops when he was first called many years earlier at the first Continental Congress or when all those things were unfolding, now he felt absolutely inadequate to be leading the Constitution, and he had wrestled with whether he should take it. But since he was unanimously elected and had actually called for the Continental Congress in the first place where he presided, he felt he had no choice but to leave his beloved Mount Vernon and take his place of leadership. So these are his opening words, beginning a new phase of American history under the Constitution.
Wow. And let me quickly add, before we even get into some of those words, you were mentioning earlier that here he was setting precedents as the first president. And so the Constitution doesn't stipulate that you must be sworn in on the Bible, but that's the normal that was, and I guess for some, even in some ways, it's still the norm in some contexts for taking an oath to be sworn in on the Bible. To, again, the words, so help me God, they were not in the Constitution, but he added those. And then they had a Christian worship service that lasted for about 2 hours at St. Paul's Chapel. And did he give this inaugural address before that worship service or after? I'm not even sure.
Yes, he gave it beforehand. And I think the thing that's important is to realize is that when the oath was taken, the Bible was brought forward, and following in the Anglican custom, he bent over and kissed the Bible. Mm. That was part of the Virginia custom that was, as an Anglican, and that was a way of saying that my lips should honor what this book requires of me. If I'm going to take an oath, I'm committed to it.
Wow.
And in the oaths that Washington had taken as a surveyor, as a vestryman, as a, let's say, a member of the House of Burgesses in Virginia, those oaths often had the language, so help me God, as part of the oath. And so the while the Constitution does not require those words, it was a natural thing, even as he bent over to follow the custom of kissing the Bible as part of his oath-taking, that he would say these words, so help me God. And it has essentially become an ongoing custom.
Yes.
Following Washington having set this precedent. Having given this speech and having been brought into position, then as you say, that's when then the worship service followed later, and it was, as we remember, Mrs. Alexander Hamilton, who's reported to her family, I had the joy of kneeling and taking communion with the newly inaugurated president as we celebrated this auspicious occasion of this inauguration.
That's terrific. Now, in the inaugural address itself, he says this: it would be peculiarly improper to omit in this first official act my fervent supplications to that almighty being who rules over the universe, who presides in the councils of nations, and whose providential aids can supply every human defect, that his benediction may consecrate to the liberties and happiness of the people of the United States, a government instituted by themselves for these essential purposes. So in other words, he's saying the first thing we must do is thank God for the ability to, you know, create our own government.
Yes, that is the great American experiment, the idea that they were coming together not only to throw off what was on every hand identified by Americans as a tyrannical form of government, denying constitutions, not respecting the promises that government had made, but now they came to create it, knowing they had to have a government to be able to freely establish their own government. They recognized that was a providential gift. How often does that get to happen in the life of a nation? So they saw that there was a need to recognize God. In fact, I love his language, his fervent supplications to that almighty being who rules over the universe. Again, that's the basis of his belief in providence. God exists. He is sovereign over everything, which means he's sovereign in the birth of a nation. But it also underscores why he was a man of prayer, fervent supplications, his heartfelt belief that he had to cry out for God to supply even his own defects as a leader, saying, I'm going to make mistakes. I've never done this before. But I have to believe that somehow God is going to use me because he's sovereign over everything. So he's appealing to God personally and as well as nationally in this moment.
Hmm. And he also says in the speech, in tendering this homage to the great author of every public and private good, I assure myself that it expresses your sentiments not less than my own, nor those of my fellow citizens at large, less than either. So now we'll go ahead and comment on that, if you would. And I could ask you this, if you don't mind. And we've referenced this before. He sometimes uses these phrases like almighty being, great author of every public good, invisible hand is coming up in a quote that we'll have in just a moment. Why didn't he say God, Lord, Jesus, you know, instead of using these kinds of terms?
Well, the best explanation that I have been able to uncover based on the history in which he is living is that the great preachers of the day, the orators of his time that were gospel preachers, they used these glorious terms of expansive reverence for God as a way of never speaking of deity, if they could help it, in the same phrase. If God is an omnipotent being, an all-glorious being, a God of all grace, then why would we refer to him with such humble words as God or Lord when we have all of his attributes and all of his mighty gifts? It fits, as it has been described, as the Baroque period, when there's all of the flourishing in art and music and architecture, all of that intricate design. This was actually part of the theology, that we could speak of God in many, many different ways. So one of the studies, Jerry, that I know you and I really appreciated was looking at Thomas Paine, the writer of The Age of Reason, the father of hardcore deism. What was his vocabulary for God? Well, it's about four words. God. And when you look at Washington's, when we trace it, he has, in his writings, we found something like 95 different names for deity in Washington's writings, and he's not even a theologian.
Yeah.
But when you look at those great terms, they're not found in deist writings, they're found in the great preachers of the day. So I would describe it as a holy reverence of Baroque theology. Why not describe God with the many different facets of the diamond of his glory as we speak of him? That's what Washington is doing, especially at such a public moment where he is speaking as the newly inaugurated president. He's speaking of God, and he wants to see him in his majesty. So he describes him with just a plethora of beautiful terms describing God in his transcendence and glory.
You know, there is a sense in which, and this is a different topic for a different time or whatever, but there is a sense in which contemporary evangelicalism has lost much of its reverence for God, the reverence that is due him. I mean, you can even see it in all kinds of different manifestations, but somebody was describing a worship service that he went to when there were strobe lights and the pastor was in blue jeans, and it's just like, wow, you know, it's so different than the church experience of his day, and even in our day of the high church. But as I say, that's a different issue. Bottom line is, we should be reverent.
You've given red meat to a hungry dog here, so yeah. I'm going to jump in on that.
All right.
You know, the balance of this is that in Christian theology, we have the emphasis on the transcendence of God and also the immanence of God. And we realize that God is over us, but we realize that God is with us. And when we compromise either one for the other, we distort the truth of who God is.
Good.
So if our worship is only the chumminess of, let's say, a Jesus who walks with us, we've lost his glory.
Yeah.
And if we only have the view of one who's way out there and he's majestic, then we've forgotten what he stooped down and became like us. And so the challenge of biblical teaching and preaching and liturgy and worship is to maintain his closeness and his transcendence at the same time, because both are biblical. And I think that's one of the things that are really needful as corrective. So the peril of the pendulum, we can say he's so far over us or he's so close to us. Well, guess what? They're both true, and we must maintain them to keep ourselves unbearing. So that's at least a thought.
Sure. And the final thought on this particular segment, you know, related to the first inaugural address of President George Washington, he talked about how nobody could be more grateful or should be more grateful than the people of the United States, because in our attempts to create a free country and so forth, God helped us every step along the way.
And these words, again, we hear Washington's sincere belief that what had happened in the American story was impossible to be explained by human means. He said future historians are going to look at this and say, it just couldn't have happened this way. And Washington said, we can only say that God intervened at different times for a purpose to bring forth this nation. Now, there are people that mock that, ridicule that. They say it's foolish, that American exceptionalism is a self-aggrandizing view. But our founders said we shouldn't even exist apart from something supernatural.
Wow.
And they were specific and open about that. And I think as Americans, whether we believe it or not, we should not expunge it from the record. This is what they firmly believed. And if we're biblically minded Christians, we can say, well, you know what? That is what the Bible teaches, that God is in fact a sovereign God who accomplishes his purposes. That he says he raises up nations and he brings them down. And he has his purposes. He establishes the boundaries of nations for their time. And all we can do now at this point is pray that the purposes of God for bringing America into being will not be lost sight of, one of which was to give religious liberty. Another one was to be a source of freedom to the world. But most importantly, a place, a bastion of Christian truth to be proclaimed to the ends of the earth, which is what the seminaries we've studied at and where I'm leading at Westminster, for example, it's touching the world. And why? Part of it is because of the extraordinary freedoms that God's people were able to bring in North America. And it, let me tell you, it is unparalleled in the world as we look at other countries and their repression of freedom of conscience. Mm-hmm. What a great gift God has given America.
Dr. Peter Loback, ProvidenceForum.org. Thank you so much for being with us, Dr. Loback. Appreciate it.
It's always a pleasure.
Okay.